Welcome to the Turnaround Mindset podcast with your hosts, behavioral economist and psychologist Phil Slade, and successful business leader and accountant Adam Smith. Each week, our hosts will unpack the tough and intimate questions we all face as professionals, offering no-nonsense business advice to those bold enough to think and act differently. Now, here are your hosts, Phil and Adam.
Every now and then, you have a conversation that really surprises you. This is one of those conversations. Dr. Karuna Ramanathan came across our radar as a recommendation from a mutual friend who said we would be crazy not to have a chat with him, and they weren't wrong. Karuna was a naval warship captain and leadership trainer for the Singaporean Armed Forces, who then became a senior principal in the Prime Minister's office in Singapore. He then went on to build a leadership coaching business and be recognized as one of the top 10 organizational development consultants in 2023 by the Asia Business Outlook, and nominated by the business magazine CEO Insights Asia as one of Asia's most influential leaders and achievers of 2023. This is a great walk through the psyche of an incredible leader and a chat that I know you're going to love. Let's dive into the heart and mind of Dr. Karuna Ramanathan.
You were just talking to us then about one of the main focuses of what you're seeing with some of the nuances that are happening in middle management. Do you want to just start there?
Oh, lovely. Okay. Study organizations like I have had the privilege to over the few years. You'll find that most organizations are actually maybe 5%, 3 to 5% leaders right at the top. And, you know, you have like 50 to 60% of people on the line, on ground. And if you think through it a little bit more, the people on the ground simply live on rules and processes, and they get to work and they know what needs to happen and they just man the station and they go back. It's the people who are caught literally in the middle, the 30, 40%, maybe even lesser, depending on what kind of organization it is, who are actually your project managers, team leaders, supervisors. So let's call them the middle managers. They might even be individuals who are actually having to work across an organization. And we're starting to realize quite quickly, at least in this side of the world, that this group of people are in an uncomfortable position. They've never been trained to actually become leaders, which they need to now, because it's not just about managing the work. It's more about relating to people and working actually with people whom you may not exactly be instinctively drawn to, you know, that dynamics and all that. And so basically, you then have a big problem now, because you actually want to just get your work done, and you get the key performance indicator kind of language, and you're so used to seeing everything through the filter of work that we end up, this group of people end up struggling. They struggle to cope, they struggle to adapt, they struggle to learn. And that's fast becoming the kind of work that we are increasingly being drawn to. I mean, I think there's a real purpose out there to help as many managers as possible, we'll say middle managers out there, to become a little bit more influential. Because from the work that we do, and I've just been doing this over the last few years, it's actually very, very surprising to see just how people and this middle manager group underestimates their influence, and they actually have tremendous influence in an organization. And getting them up to that is actually going to be required that we make leaders out of them. It's not in positional leadership. It's actually the good old definition of leadership as influence. And we all are these leaders. We are these way at home. I mean, we are fathers, we are mothers, we are brothers, we are caregivers, we are sisters, whatever that might be, right? So we have it in us to press that switch. It's a deliberate shift to wanting to gear into that kind of a attitude towards how we see things at work quite differently. That's the kind of purpose-driven work that we are into. I don't know whether this makes enough sense.
That increased stress in management, is that, you know, you've got sort of internal factors and external factors. And yeah, we all know that there are some external factors that are at play here. There's COVID recently, the different working arrangements and work from homes and different in terms of the division of labor in a home and things like that are shifting and different things. The context is different nowadays for sure. But how much do you think the internal factors are playing? So not just that there are stresses being put on the system, But there's always been stress in the system. There's always been stress in middle management. There's always been severe economic pressures. And one could argue that management's pressure cooker was probably higher in the 80s and 90s when you didn't have this culture matrix, you know, where you could be a borderline psychopathic manager to your staff, and that was just considered normal. So one could argue that the external factors have actually lessened, and yet you're seeing a growth in stress. Does that mean that we're becoming less able to cope with stress? Are our internals diminishing in your opinion?
10 to 15 years, we are starting to like get into that whole, oh my God, this is the internet, you know, and these are all the distractions and there's all these devices around us. 10 years ago, a week in Bangkok would have meant no iPad, no laptop, no handheld device. But right now it is. I mean, I'm going to pack all those three in my bag and sneak it in there, you know, I mean, and just find time to kind of check in. So I guess what has happened is, you know, attention deficits, attentive capacities, we are multitasking, we are on the go, we are always gearing in. And it is a success definition. It is closely associated with, it's very little to do with happiness. And that's been a major, major issue with us. We can't turn away from it. The thing about a silent retreat is it's just going to be so painful for most of us. So it's no longer in our psyche to do that. So how do we then cope with this? I mean, do we make sure we put in some deliberate discipline as you know, hardcore military leadership type, which I've actually had a bit of a background in that. Detach yourself from certain situations. You actually say, I'm present, I'm not present, I'm here, it's my time, it's your time, I'm taking time. Or do you just learn to cope with it a little better? And actually, there is that for organizations, the middle managers are going to have to deal with this really quickly, if not the external pressures, as you point out, might just overwhelm them. And there's a lot of this internal thing going on. I'll add one more thing. In Singapore, I think we are actually starting to suffer from a success mindset. And that is, it's, you know, it's been, it's in all these books. I mean, we see it, we see infographics on it. I mean, think success, but success is largely defined and dependent on me as an individual. And a lot of that manifests itself at work. Happiness, on the other hand, is largely dependent on the people around me. And so how happy they are. Very difficult for me to see a situation where I could be happy and my concept of family at home is not happy. Whereas it's success, I can choose to be the person I am at work in order to achieve what I seek to achieve. And depending on whether that's purposefully driven or whether that's for profit or whatever the case might be. And then you then decide where that balance is, because, and as I say this to people, between success and happiness lies, it's like a seesaw. You know, at times in your life, it goes up and it goes down and it goes up and it goes down. But that fulcrum, you know, pivot in the middle is actually that your identity. And so at this point, at this juncture and going forward, I hold a belief that we actually need to actually think a little harder about who we choose to be. And a lot of that, manifests itself in this strange place called work that's becoming increasingly troubling and difficult to define for most of us.
Mm.
I think for me, what I'm beginning to understand, Karuna, is that you talk about this constant need to check in, the almost the immediate fix that comes from social media, the dopamine hits that used to come from a cup of coffee, or having something to eat or whatever it might be. It's constant, it's there, it's instant, it's available 100% of the time. And as you mentioned, it's now obviously massively impacting work. It's this constant need to be looking good, to be successful, the whole thing. How do you even empower or even talk to leaders about how they need to focus and actually channel their energy into the right things?
When I coach C-suites, right, this whole thing comes up with that gift you have, that moment you have, it will pass you. We've all known great leaders as to how they make us feel in the moment, that presence that you must cultivate quite deliberately to be able to make it seem as if to the other person that that 3 minutes, sort of 5 minutes of that interaction is your give all into that situation or the conversation. And that's one of that, to answer your question, that's one of the baseline requirements to make to treat a person with utmost respect. This person has, and if you are a leader in a position of leadership, you are actually, someone has prepared themselves to come up to tell you something, and the least you could do, the impact you will have on that person simply by being totally present and to give your 3 to 5 minutes of undivided attention, not distracted, not on the device, not on your laptop. And we see it so often in meeting rooms, right? Top leaders trying to multitask as well. They're looking at their phones. They're looking at their laptops and iPads. They're scrolling. You say, yeah, my eyes are there. Yeah, go on. Come on, can carry on. Or what about, you know, someone's prepared 3 weeks to brief you and you say, I've got 5 minutes and can just get to the gist of it. And that is so disrespectful. So just to answer that question, it's one of the most important things is our requirement as leaders to actually treat the other, the people we are privileged to lead, with the deepest respect we can carve out of ourselves. And that's a big shift. It is actually a deliberate step forward to want to engage with a person on that basis. That's really, for me, the gist of it.
So what you're talking about is creating basic rules or guardrails around how you navigate the world around you and throughout the business day. And I suppose one of those things is that focused attention. I know one of the things that Dr. Adam Fraser talks about here in Australia, he's got some interesting work. He's done some incredible studies where he looks at people that are in constant back-to-back online meetings, Teams meetings, Zoom meetings or whatever. And they've found that if people just make those Zoom meetings 55 minutes rather than 60 minutes, and in that 5 minute gap, go and have a cup of tea or do something like that, that their brain resets almost for that next meeting so that they're just as good the fifth meeting in as they are the first meeting. Whereas if they don't take that break, their brains have basically checked out by the time that they hit that fourth or fifth meeting. It's an example of a guardrail to just work with what you've got in order to create that sense of agency and for people to know that they have that sense of agency in order to design that kind of rule in their lives is often mind-blowing, because they think, well, how can I do that? I'm not in that. But they're kind of two tips. One is, you know, practice your focused attention on a thing. One is create some guardrails around your hourly meetings. Are there other tips and tricks that you've seen or that when you do your coaching that you go, do some of these things, this will help you straight away?
So I'm going to do this afterwards myself. So
yeah.
So I'm getting on a plane with my wife. It's a short trip. It's It's 2.5 hours to Bangkok, and I'm going to be present. I'm actually going to practice it. I'm going to be very deliberate. But the flight crew, maybe the cabin crew would ask me a question. I'm going to be present. I'm going to put the phone away. So these are the practice all the time, because the impact we have on people as leaders is real, and for the large part, unintentional. For most people, and that's where the self-awareness thing comes in. You didn't really realize that's what that person took away, either subconsciously or consciously, from the impact we had on them. And good leaders. So when I coach, I just say, you just map everything you do. Watch yourself like a hawk. Get to the fly on the wall. Look at what's this going to happen. I would say not even 55 minutes. I would say 45 minutes for a call, and then get up and do the leg stretch. I would even say have two screens. I would say have two chairs. I'd say put your back to it, shift into another space altogether. Be prepared. And the happiest thing that for most people these days is when you can cut short right through the time and shut it down to just say, all right, that'll do. Let's get going. If people need to heave a sigh of relief. And so all these little things that you don't really need to have someone tell you other than you tell yourself.
I love that. Changing tack slightly. We're talking a lot about, sort of psychological preparedness and being able to look at focus. There's a particular element of psychological safety when we talk about psych safety in a workplace that centers around the organization's ability to have a culture of coaching, and that you'll have your old dogs, you know, coaching your new dogs and doing it kind of naturally, that the culture is geared towards that. I find it interesting that this has become increasingly relevant, this whole idea of psychological safety, in the last 5 years. And also, so has the work from home scenario. And for people that are 100% working from home, it's hardly a culture of coaching that's being created in an organization that is largely disparate in its workforce. I'm interested to know, how do you approach that?
There are only two forms of working for the longest time. One is the co-location model, and the other is the remote model. And we know that the remote model that is really very successful in places where there was geographical reasons to actually not come into work, like, for example, in the UK, in the US. It's a choice made both by, it's actually a respected choice made both by the employee and the employer. Now, one of the preconditions for the remote model is simply the need for work to be clearly defined on the back of a competent or proficient individual. So you would actually take that work away and you would actually deliver it, say, within 2 weeks or something. And if need be, you get into the office and you do that. Now, here we have a hybrid model, and it says work from home. And simply because it's just an extension of telecommuting, which used to be a favor given to individuals, that, you know, all right, you can just work from home, but you're still pretty much having to work in relation to what the manager wants and not what the manager believes can be delivered. So this entire shift, so getting to the question, is the first thing we try to make in the manager or the leader, to say that, are you prepared to let this individual actually operate from his or her choice location and allow and trust that individual so that he or she has that safety to be able to work on whatever he or she is asked to do, and then get that back to you at whatever juncture. And it could be actually staggered out in terms of, I've got boss, I've got a couple of questions for you, and I need to ask you this, versus, oh my God, is this really going to work? Is this what she wants? Is this what he wants? And that's a lot of that going on right now. It's that whole muddled state where things are, because tasks are not well defined, job requirements and specifications, standards are not there. And it's one thing to say all this, guys, but it's also another thing to just imagine how difficult it is to actually define these things. And it's a lot going out there, and it's a lot, I call it all muddled up right now. So very little in the form of the traditional Amy Edmondson psychological safety piece, but I think there needs to be a fundamental rethink on the relationship between the supervisor and the individual in relation to the nature of the work. And not everything is going to sit hunky-dory remote or work from home. There's some things that, for example, lawyers, people who do legal work, they can actually work off. I mean, I know many good lawyers who actually work straight from home, as would maybe accountants, depending on whether the site is secure. But there are some people, like marketing people, I mean, the people in channel management, the sales type people, you need to get them going, and it's a very, very uncomfortable. So there are different, not enough has been done to redefine the expectations around work and the expectations around the skill levels. For example, a competent or proficient individual versus someone who's just started out would be very, very daunting. I recall my son starting out straight out of school, he actually studied in Melbourne, and then he actually came back here, and then he started work with a finance house, and it was utter horror and pain because it was in the middle of the COVID, and he was talking to screens the whole day, and he just gave up. I mean, mm-hmm. He just said, it's not for me. I'm totally lost. So that's a lot of stuff that's going on. So coming back right into the question, I would ask leaders to actually pay a little bit more attention to what they want done and how it's going to be done and who they want working on it, and to be fairly explicit to the extent possible, which most leaders, actually like us, we just struggle from time to time. We think it's something that you should know, but for most people, they become very anxious when they don't know enough. Now, so psychological safety is a leadership act. It is, to me, it's inclusivity. It's basically pulling you in and allowing you the freedom to actually feel safe within the confines of that relationship. Some of that's coaching, some of that's mentoring, but I go back to the basic word. Some of it is just basic respect for that individual's state of being.
Mm-hmm. How do you sort of advise leaders in this new world that we're in, Karuna? Like from our side here in Australia, as you mentioned, Phil, already, that you know there's such a large percentage of us working from home on Zoom calls, on Teams calls. This need to then say, well, we're also trying to mobilize people with coaching, et cetera. Like organizational culture plays such a massive component in whether transformation is successful or not. Especially now, given they're driving all sorts of different next generational technologies, AI, big data, IoT for business transformations to help assist in that process. Like what factors now, when you take into consideration this new sort of virtual organizational culture that we're all operating within, you know, what drives a successful business transformation?
Oh, so many factors. I mean, like basically put it down simply to, I don't think strategy is the problem for most organizations. You have enough clever people right at the top of organizations who have earned the right to be there for the large part. They've gone to the great schools. They have actually had all the great experiences. They've come highly rated and they should be able to bang out the strategy. And if you had some problems with that, you get some consultants, they help you, which is where most organizations are. The large part of the problem is when it starts coming down into the organization. And that's really, really difficult for most middle managers because these are the very same people who keep your organization running, and you're now loading them and you're confusing them and you're confusing the rhetoric for the narrative that they hold, that firstly they probably think that they're not treated well enough and paid enough, they're getting the raw end of the deal, and you're asking them to do new things and they're not with you, they're working away from you. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that whole anxiety, the lack of assurance, the lack of clarity. Now, we call these the execution challenge, and it's very real. And culture, unfortunately, you know, sends shudders down me, you know, because it always becomes the excuse for why things don't work. And there's already a 75% chance, if you go by the statistics, that most transformations are not going to take off the way they were actually thought they would, or the leaders thought they would. So where are we now? You actually have to probably do three things. Let's get down to the point. The first is remembering that most managers got to where they are, middle managers, these good people in the middle, they are real, they are facing pressures and challenges, and they actually got to where they are because they were dependable. They were dependable on the work. They were dependable. They were people you could be trusted to deliver. And to them, the currency is simply, when will I deliver this? How task-focused I need to be? Just push away everything that is, and here we go. Push away everything that's not real, not clear, not right, not... And let me just do my core business. And that's a counterproductive to organizations right now, because actually you have middle managers just kind of sitting down and centering on exactly what they believe they can deliver. And a lot of this transformation stuff comes out or starts off with, oh my goodness, this is highly risky. So we're just not going to, let's save our resources for the stuff that we can deliver. And lo and behold, I mean, you actually have performance management systems that actually reward that, right? It's all about the what. It's what where's my laundry list of KPIs that I met so that I can actually, hey, I deserve that promotion. So we're seeing this very confused state right now, very difficult state right now, where organizations seeking to transform are choking in the middle. And so what do we then do? What's possible? The first and shift, and we actually have work that we're doing with an organization in Singapore for this. The first and necessary shift is to kind of help most managers kind of become more aware that they actually have people responsibilities. They need to take care of people. They have to actually reach out left and right, top and down. Instead of just looking up and down, they're going to have to look left and right as well. They're going to have to be curious as to what's going on with this other person who's actually in Zoom and team meetings, you know, the whole day with them. they're going to have to assess competence. They're going to have to wonder about whether the person lacks the competence or is simply getting incompetent or is just disengaged or is just troubled or what. That read is actually quite important right now. And do we have that? Yes, most people do, because we have families at home and we practice that all the time. You know, we look left and right. So it's getting that switch. The switch is in every one of that middle managers. So I call that, or at least in the work that's popping up now, moving from manager to leader. So maybe a one or two or three steps. And it's nothing too, there's no manual to this. It's just an awareness exercise that you just have to think around you versus just look and keep looking at the work this way. That's the first part. So I'll say manager to leader. It's foundational leadership pieces. Some organizations would get away by simply giving some people coaching. Some would actually put in some kind of manager mentoring program. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is, it just needs to get going. And leaders need to come together to decide what they're going to expect of their people and hold themselves to those very standards as well. And say that this is how it's going to happen. And that goes back to the culture piece, right? I mean, like, the only way this is going to get redefined is when we do it together. The second is a little bit more difficult. Once you have that, then you might want to pick on and do some analysis of the organization as to where are these managers that are going to be most exposed to the trust of that transformation. So you could actually scan the organization. I mean, leave the finance people out, leave the legal people, leave corporate services out, but you might actually have some people right at the forefront of that change. And you're going to have to make sure that those managers are prepared to be adaptive. We call them adaptive team leaders. And that's something that you can actually help them to do, because most people don't want to work with people they don't like. And then the question becomes, how do you actually build professional relationships at work and stop looking for love, which is everyone looks for love at work. And the third, which is probably the most difficult to do, and this is actually a sense of sense-making skills, is inevitably all transformation carries with it high degrees of complexity, and most of us are just not ready to think through that. I think in our work, change leadership is essentially a skill that you actually put people through in order to actually be able to take on that complexity with a little bit more confidence, to be able to probe it, to be able to build the data around it, to be able to build information and knowledge around it. So in a gist, the foundational piece, the adaptive piece for most people, and for a select few, maybe the change piece. And this could be a talent pipeline to have motivations to want to show that they can actually do more work. So I'll just pause there, guys.
I'm interested to know how you apply some of this when we go out of the context of a market-driven business or corporation, and we start to see it within a government department or something that's got a large level of bureaucracy around it, where arguably, I mean, the central of your sort of argument is employees in that power relationship don't understand how much agency they have over their own state and their own and sort of stepping into that agency and leaders stepping into that leadership. But in some bureaucracies, there's an overarching belief that the power is too far on the other foot, in that they can't get fired. And so without this sort of threat of underperformers being moved on, there's no way that you can start to shift employees as a leader. And so these leaders and managers feel like that they've got no power or agency, and they're working, then they might have a team of 10 people and only two of them are actually high performers. So two people end up doing the work of 10 people and the eight people are just or vice versa, whatever the ratio is. But you understand those two people end up sort of burned out and stressed in middle management. I'm just interested to know, in that sort of scenario, and I should say the only way that the bureaucracies at the moment are dealing with that is to create chaos in the system, right? They restructure and they keep restructuring and they keep restructuring in order to create chaos, where hopefully they shake out the dead wood. And what ends up happening, of course, is that the people that are kind of burnt out, that are actually doing well, get poached, and the people that are dead wood hanging on and staying. And so it has the opposite effect, right? So I'm interested to know, in that scenario, what do you say to those managers that are working in what they would perceive to be a low power differential?
One of the hardest places to do any kind of transformation is that bureaucratic, largely government state. It's just so damn hard. I was bothered by it for a couple of years. I mean, given my background, but I've had the benefit of working 7 years out on my own now, and I think it all boils down to accountability. So I say this quite cheekily, but I don't mean any disrespect, right? Anyone who has not served in a military might be excused for not fully appreciating the extent to which leaders can be deemed capable. Military history is really full of examples of men and women sacrificing their lives, doing all those noble things. And after a while, you can't get carried away with it. I mean, this is the ultimate leadership test, right? To lay your life down for someone, for a larger cause. Okay. But actually, when you think about it, the military background, the profession carries with it the notion of unlimited liability. You get trained for that. It's a choice you make. And in the unfortunate eventuality of hostility, you are trained to put your life down for a cause. That does not happen in organizations and certainly not in a government. Now, let's take the other extreme. Anyone who has not worked in government should be excused for not fully appreciating how incapable leaders might look. This is the other end of the spectrum, right? And if we dig that a little deeper in that whole paradigm, it's because actually government as a system is accountable to people. Politicians run in front of that. But government, anyone in government, when taken aside, what are you really accountable for? I think most government, hardworking government officers would have trouble describing what they're really accountable for. And that mindset carries with it, I just come to work, do my work, and I make sure I do it according to process. And I make sure that all the underpinnings of a bureaucracy that kind of manifests itself quite nicely, and it's a defense. So bureaucracy is a major defense in efficient machinery, the government's machinery. And here we are trying to transform really. So the ultimate transformation would be to break and rebuild and a bit of that chaos, right? So you find a lot of government agencies trying to spawn off new entities, but they end up exactly what you say. They end up frustrating the few or the minority who are actually throwing themselves in. And after a while, and we've seen it so many times, I'm sure in Singapore and Australia, it's all the same. The people who actually step out of the comfort zone to actually push themselves and the system just burn themselves out or just give up, and the structure is overwhelming. So we're going to have a really, really big problem. In my work, I would say to anyone that actually the hardest place to transform is a well-defined bureaucracy, a government state. That doesn't mean that they don't have great ideas. It's just, how do you get that going? And the other thing that happens here is a lot of that collaboration we need to see is actually confused for coordination with leadership powers. So when you find crises after crises, like the COVID that we just saw in many countries, you have task forces that are being set up, you have ministers, you have senior government officers who actually kind of sit at top of meetings and they actually pull resources together. Now, that's not collaboration. For a lot of the transformation to happen, you actually need minds to come together and to work together. And that's the new leadership call for people in the center. So there's a huge skill set gap that we need to build very quickly. And this is for all the aspiring leaders out there. Every one of us is a leader, and the extent to which you can be successful can be defined by you. You can pick up sense-making skills very quickly, think critically, do a whole lot of stuff. I mean, the LinkedIn is full of stuff these days, but my point is we all can choose to be better versions of ourselves to actually focus down and become more successful. So yeah, that's the thing about the transformation in government and bureaucracy.
So what I'm hearing, though, is that you're saying that one of the biggest problems that you see in Brisbane is that roles and descriptions and expectations are poorly defined, and yet in a government organisation, it's the rigidity of the definitions that are causing the problem. I'm wondering, is what you're saying and sort of reading between the lines is that high clarity is good, but high rigidity is not. So where you've got high clarity and high flexibility, then you've got you've got a nice system where you've got low clarity and flexibility. You've just got choose your own adventure and some psychological distress that sits there. But if you've got high clarity and high rigidity, then you've got a suffocation that sort of happens internally in the organization. Have I heard that correctly?
Very nicely put. I would just say it goes back to structure. And in a bureaucracy, you literally have, most people have difficulty with the concept of teams. They think that teamwork is teams. But if you take that apart, actually, there are two very different ways of working. Highly bureaucratic organizations have very well-defined organization charts. And these are waterfall frames that actually define your job descriptions, which are largely individual. So actually, I'm rewarded for the work I do. And if I do not make a mistake and I make sure I do what I'm told, and if I deliver it faster, I should get more reward. That is fair expectation. And that permeates right through the system and it becomes so deeply entrenched. And whether that's rigidity or the lack of flexibility is, of course, it depends on which organization. But after a while, the culture settles down into known ways of working and risk aversion, and basically do not make mistakes because it's costly. Now, the concept of team does not sit on job description. Teams sit on roles. So I think, and often I've wondered, what tends to be lacking in many of these strict, rigid, bureaucratic organizations is you can't work in a team. You simply work in well-defined structures, and they all come down like a waterfall. But going left or right becomes incredibly difficult, and it goes back to the power differential, and then there's power over the other. And we all know what happens with power. Actually, it runs inversely to psychological safety. I mean, in a way, there's research on it. It's just that I do not feel safe bringing up my point of view when this person who is more senior to me could actually define my performance.
Speaking of not being able to bring up your point of view in a safe way, working with the Prime Minister's office pre this little 7-year journey, I'm interested to go, what was that like working in the Prime Minister's office?
Intense. let me just lay it on record. The unit, the public service division, was actually under the Prime Minister's office. So I didn't actually work directly with the Prime Minister. This was the government layer, but it required very senior government officers coming together to discuss difficult and sometimes inconvenient things. So that was my role, to facilitate those conversations. It was safe enough to be in the system, so I was an internal consultant there. But it was very intense.
Can I ask, that transition out of a situation where I imagine you've got, you are working within bureaucracy, but you've got this one voice that as soon as this one voice says something, everyone just changes immediately, and the system can change from breakfast to brunch significantly, and you've got to deal with that. But I imagine starting your own business and building a business, and you've been given multiple business awards because of what you've been able to achieve. What are some of the shifts in the psychological shifts you had to undergo in order to be to build a successful business? Because I think most people don't really understand what it is to build a successful business until you're building it. And no matter how much expertise that you bring to the table around economics or around psychology or around business at a theoretical level, there's some fundamental things that you can only learn by doing. What are some of those fundamental things that you only learn by doing?
I've had the privilege of rediscovering myself.
It's just a privilege, really?
It's a privilege. I think most people do not have that privilege for whatever reason, or they chose not to actually do that. Mm-hmm. But I was really, this was such a privilege the last 7 years. It required that I redefine my notions or the balance between success and happiness. It was crazy leaving a well-paying, very respected position. I mean, I was a senior principal organizational development consultant that had that on the door. You know, it was fairly senior, and basically there was enough work that was already done that would get all the recognition you need to. And I was reminded more than once that as a retired military career officer, being told that you have another stint in government for 10 years was bonus enough. And I chose to leave that. And I remember sitting in the car park in my car after tendering. And I realized I didn't know how to resign because I never resigned. I just retired, right? And then this was a real resignation, guys, you know? And so I sat in the car park and I said, it's done. It's like, as if you're like, I'm just going to kill myself or something, you know? What did I do, you know? And that slow drive back, and it was picking up. It's a privilege to pick up all the pieces around you again and not to be lulled and not to be, and to keep your values with you and not to be dragged into the unethical lines at times where you know, the boundaries. And I think what I owe it all to is the fact that I did not have to redefine my happiness when I did that. I had the support of my family and at the close watch of my wife, of course, you know, watchful eyes, you know, just making sure that I didn't stress. And there were days where my back would hurt and I would take on too much. And I would, because you fear for your next paycheck, which is what most people actually, and being used to being paid every month, you know, I would have to deal with the fact that you might not be. And you begin to wonder whether what you have is of any use to anyone. And then you start pulling yourself together and over the 7 years, what would you choose to be? And what are you actually after? And what does all this mean? And how are you going to balance? And how are you going to be? I'm still working at it. How do you become more purposeful and present in your relationships that matter to you? And it's like I said, I'm having this dilemma now. Is it the iPad? Is it a laptop? Is it what's going to go with me in the bag, you know? And it's just not fair, right? So it's been a tremendous 7 years, and I've just been so grateful that I've actually been given all that support at home to deal with this. Simply put.
Can I just drill down a little bit into, you said there was those moments where you had to pull yourself together. I'm interested to know, from a listener's perspective, one of the big problems that people have is they're thinking that their experience isn't like everyone else's, and that their challenges are only challenges because they're not good enough or they're not capable enough. They very rarely hear of the depth and the visceral struggle that a lot of successful people still go through, that's very actually similar to theirs, you know. And I'm interested to know a little bit of context, like if you could paint a picture around what did it mean for you in that moment. Paint us the picture of you in that moment where you had to pull yourself together. And then as part B of that, I'm keen to know, what are the things that you did to help you pull yourself together? Was it just a big deep breath, and was it just a bit of time? Was it someone's a word from someone? What were the things that pulled you away? So context first, and then what you did to pull yourself together.
So it is, I mean, the work that I do and a few people like me do, it's actually really how to put it. It's there are no safety nets, so that makes it worse. You work well with clients and you help leaders and you make a positive impression on them and they enjoy working with you. You get called back. None of this is social media advertising. None of it is blowing your own trumpets. I mean, the credentials and the street credit, the credentials and the qualifications are there, but it's a street credit. So now that already generates problems, because it is, you have people saying they can do the work you do and they can do it for better than you do. And then you have all these dynamics out there and you have leaders who actually fear you because you're like, you know, you're like a surgeon. You get in there and the nature of my work is you're actually going to tell them, cut this, chop that, do this, you get that going. And they're not going to be, for most part, they may not be comfortable trusting you. So how do you then stand up to yourself? And the only way to get to the first part of the question, though, I've had to discover that I've had to be myself. And that I will not compromise, those moral, ethical, respectful, those dealings have to be clear and based on data. It's as much a professional call as it is a leadership call, which then means these are real lives of men and women out there, and I will not allow that manipulation that tends to occur ever so subtly. And in let's just use the consultant to shift this. So I've had to deal with that more than once, and in spectacular examples, I've actually walked away from assignments that actually would have promised some economic gain. Sometimes I ask myself, why are you so stubborn about this? I mean, why didn't you just take this and move on? And I can't deal with that. I don't sleep well at night with that kind of stuff, you know. And that discovery at this age, that's why I say it's a privilege to actually rediscover yourself, to actually be able to say that these things matter to me. These things define me. This is who I choose to be. Is actually fundamental to my existence right now. And Marshall Goldsmith is a mentor, right? I mean, I'm a Marshall coach, and it's between regret and fulfillment. I mean, on a scale between regret and fulfillment, where would you place yourself if you look back at your life? And I would happily say that I'm as close to fulfillment, given that I do this every day. I'm always questioning myself now as to, what the heck? I mean, what is this? I mean, come on, deal with it. The second part of the question, if I may, let's dive in a bit. Every one of us is capable of being better versions, more successful versions of ourselves. It takes work. I mean, there's so much out there. You know, it takes hard work. It doesn't come easy, but it goes back to the choices you make, and the choices carry commitments. Those commitments are risky at times, but you would be for the better, because you will discover yourself in the process, often becoming a better version of yourself.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, more of what you're saying, Karuna, is that we're all just human beings. You know, from the point of view of all the leaders that you are advising, coaching, taking them in directions of where a company needs to transform. What I'm always keen to know is that, you know, transformational companies, generally they have leaders that are pretty forthcoming about new strategies, new processes, and they're quite sort of open to change and all that sort of stuff. But the one thing I've found is there's a great book that was written by Jeffrey Moore called Zone to Win. And he divides a company into sort of four different zones based on their role. That a person plays, so performance, productivity, transformation, and incubation. Most organizational leaders, even when you're talking to them at the core of who they are very open to sort of say, well, okay, this new strategy, this new process. But the hardest question, almost all of them have never been able to answer properly in my sort of 20 years experience, is, have you identified where the transformation needs to begin? How do you actually advise the leaders that you're talking to about where that transformation needs to begin within a company?
Yeah, that's a straight down the line answer to that. Is your strategy clear enough? Who's approved it? Did the board actually approve it? How did you get to this strategy? And this is really where the trouble starts, trouble in a difficult kind of way, right? Most times the vision is confused for the strategy, and also most times the leader's ambition falls into the vision. And I take those two, and I think it's Ronald Heifetz's work coming out of Harvard. That's a really dangerous state to be in, because it's going to inflict a lot of pain on a lot of people who actually hold on to resources, and you actually commit this to all kinds of airy fairy ideas. So to answer that question, there's a technical assessment that we do with the strategy, and we kind of crimp that into, say, time zones, and let's just look at a near states of where you want to get to in the next 12 to 18 months, and kind of pull down one more level from that strategy with some granularity, some projects that you actually think you could get on doing. Then there's this assessment of capacity, capability, and commitment, as transformation projects would actually require stakeholders and partners. So that's all technical stuff. But I think where we really make a difference is I help the leaders identify -1s and -2s who actually might actually benefit from leading these projects for whatever reasons. They could be talent or whatever. And we get them to actually, we take them through, and we use team coaching, we transformation team coaching to actually stand up these projects in 3 to 6 months' time. Now, what we actually find out, guys, is a lot of this get through and start get going, but there is a 30% of the project load that actually might just be simply ideas that are not quite ready to work into the system. And that courage, and it's a leadership act that these leaders would actually have to deal with. Now, this is not going to work. We're going to have to stand this down because it's actually resources that we can't commit at this time. It's actually what's probably more difficult for many interested individuals who try to make a mark for themselves through this project. So just to answer the question, it's actually quite technical. So I call that entire piece of work change leadership. And you actually have to develop and help leaders to become more confident. These are the minus ones, minus twos to actually carry the projects. The CEO is not the executioner. If the CEO is going to be the executioner, there's going to be real opportunity cost. The CEO is the risk scanner. The CEO is the strategy builder. The CEO is the political interface. The CEO is not someone who leads a project. So at word go, if this is a project under the CEO, something's not going to be terribly right sooner or later. Mm. Yeah.
No, it's interesting. I often think that people struggle with what is strategy, and that they do either shoot too high or too low. You know, they either get very quickly into the detail of plans and into the weeds, or they stay up in the what does it mean in the vision pieces, and they very rarely build the bridge between the vision and the implementation in an effective way. For you, so this is not organizations that you've seen, just for you, when you're building your business, what has been the strategic decisions that you've made that has been most useful? Like how do you now think of strategy now that you're on your business, you know, as opposed to advising other businesses, you know, how do you see your strategy for you?
Is it worth doing? not that whether it's going to pay, not whether it's going to catch on, but is it really worth doing? And so to extend that, and I'm actually in this juncture right now. We have a platform that we've built over the last 2 years because we thought that micro consulting would become important in the ASEAN region because of the economic states of many of these organizations. I think my team dreads it each time when I say, can we give it away for free? If we can give it away for free, what? Give it away for free? But if we could, imagine the good that we would do. Is it worth doing? So I'm at that stage. It's not abstract altruistic. It's simply, if this was such a great idea and you're going to put your resources into it, is it really going to benefit? Is it going to benefit enough people that this would actually make a difference to someone? And if it's not, then I think that enthusiasm needs to be pulled back a little bit.
Does that have to relate to why you're doing what you're doing? Like, because is it worth doing seems to me you need to know why you're doing what you're doing in order to know that whether the value or the worth of what you're doing is there. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. It's purpose-driven.
Yeah. Do you find, though, when you're dealing with an organization where the founders are not the leaders, so now I'm sort of moving away from your organization into the organizations you talk with, how do you help them to think about, because it's very easy as a founder. Both Adam and I have both been founders of companies, and we understand what building a company is from scratch into something. We understand the pain that a lot of our listeners are going through, and it's real pain, and it's hard. It's soul destroying, and there's a lot of energy vampires out there that will get you, right? But when you're dealing with somebody that's in the leadership position or a leadership, so senior position in an organization where they're not the founders, how do you get some of that founder why? Because usually founders have got such a clear North Star, but people that come after them don't often have that North Star. Or maybe even boards, you know, when founders then get a board, you know, and it grows into a board, sometimes the board doesn't have that North Star like the founder does as well. How do you influence people to find that North Star?
A lot of that is a narrative work for us. You find that leaders naturally, senior leaders naturally gravitate towards rhetoric. It's the classic town hall. Get on the roster, get on the stage. You know what? Prance around it, walk around it. 45 minutes. Let me explain to you why this transformation is going to be necessary. It doesn't cut it with most people. They have a narrative at play, as we all do. It's our story. And with the founder, that narrative is really special and important, and emotionalizing how bringing that to life with the leadership is specific work that we do. The why is rooted in the historical context and the origins more so than the what's, which tend to come out a lot faster. So it's actually narrative work that we do quite a bit. I did one as recently as last year. It's just a day that you put 16 leaders in a room and you ask them to kind of think about why this started, where it started, and where. So it's a bit of that story and identity and all that. And again, who do you choose to be together? So it's a collective that comes out of that room on generally a common or what we call a change narrative. And that's rooted in the believability over the past as to whether this is actually what the organization chooses to stand for. So it's actually narrative work. It's quite important. And it's quite different from rhetoric. So it's quite powerful in terms of change work that we do, because a lot of it is, I don't know if you guys might be familiar with the term dialogic OD, and dialogic organizational development sits on perspectives and conversations. And it's hard, but it's important. And it actually kind of boots up the change work and the confidence in it quite significantly.
Yeah, no, it's that thing. People don't think in data. People think in stories, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, Language is the conceptual vessel that opens up the way of thinking in of itself. I often say to people that look at me like, really? And I say, well, think about something that you don't have a word for. Go.
Yeah, totally.
You know, can't do it. So, you know, like let's get some language around the way that we want to think, and then you can think that way, you know? So, yeah, it's interesting. Adam, you got a question.
I do. I sort of almost a last question, if I'm honest, in terms of it's been a really, really great chat with you, Karuna. I think we've gone in all directions, but it's the accountant in me. It's whatever it might be that's sort of leading to this question. But, you know, this post-COVID world that we're in at the moment, you know, you've been around leaders now, 38, 39 years in terms of either advising them, working through the military, et cetera, you know, in this post-COVID world that we're in right now, like, What do you think are the key traits that are needed now for any leader operating in this new environment?
At one level, I'll just react to that question by saying self-leadership. You're just going to have to take care of yourself. All of us need to take care of ourselves. I mean, there are medical reasons for it. There are psychological reasons for it. There are business reasons for it. You're going to have to watch the choices you make, and you're going to have to deal with the consequences of it. If you wear a mask, don't wear a mask. If you choose to behave irresponsibly by going out while you're having a cold. I mean, all that stuff, right? That's one level. But the other level is it's come back down to people. It's no longer the organization and its structure. And so I'm struggling at this point in kind of quick reading two books that are on organizational design. And I find those concepts grossly dated. I mean, it's now all about people. And so the advice to leaders, to get that to your question, is if you have got away with not being relatable or relational all this while, then it's time to go for that reset button and to deal with that discovery that you're going to have to make. Because people are not going to choose to work with you increasingly, and that's going to be detrimental to your success in whatever you choose to do. For those of us who are in this learning privilege position of creating those businesses and going out and dealing with ourselves, we know that, right? It comes quite instinctively. It's all about how people relate to us and how we relate to people. But in organizations, power might have been too long a defense against understanding the need for influence.
It's refreshing to hear, I was going to say, Karuna, because There's so many books that fill the shelves of any decent bookstore. That's the 7 ways to be a better leader, you know, 5 ways to do this. You know, it's been an endless supply of those sort of almost, I wouldn't say get rich quick, but sort of being able to sort of take a book off the shelf before you board a plane. And by the end of the flight, you're absolutely well informed on what the 7 characteristics of transformational leaders are. And I think that's been the biggest change that I've noticed, as well as Phil, has been just this looking inward versus out at the company seems to be such a massive change to what has been the norm, so to speak, for at least the last 25 years of my business career. That's an amazing change that's actually required there. And that vulnerability that's actually needed as a leader sort of to provide that or to showcase that side of yourself. I'm sure in your line of work, you sort of see how many would actually struggle to actually show that side of themselves as a leader.
I actually empathize with them completely. I do have once in a while I get on this crusade to say, can you give leaders a break? They're human beings. Sorry, just drop that down a little. So, and this is always the tension, right? I mean, it is seductive to think of the authentic leader. I mean, the authentic leader is someone who brings himself, his true or herself to work. And why would you want to do that? So actually, I was with a client the other day and I said, authenticity is an oversold concept. You have to be the real you in your choice relationships. I mean, if you decide to have you make a choice to have a partner, whoever he or she is, I mean, you need to show your real self to him or her. And that's the extent of authenticity, because trust is the currency that comes out of that. You deeply trust. I mean, what would be the most difficult thing to do in life is to trust someone with your money when you're dead. I mean, if you look at it that way, and this person is going to act in the right frame and do what is needed. But at work, you can and we can lower the bar. So when we work with leaders, we say, why don't you just center on respect? And most people are capable of that because of the way they were brought up quite decently. And then start practicing empathy, which actually is a mental exercise for most of us. Can we stop, pause, think of the other person, put yourself in the other person's shoes? And then as a leader, ask whether you're coming across with enough humility in relating to the person so that you don't trust your power or your weight on the person, but to actually, with empathy, actually practice that humility. And I think that bringing that one notch down and sort of getting all authentic and setting the bar so high for most people, that vulnerability, guys, is actually very doable. And I use that quite a bit in my work. And so let me restate that. Respect is core. Empathy sits on that. And humility should be something we achieve or try to practice. And we'll fall short of that, you know, every now and then, as I do. I did yesterday. I actually did something I shouldn't have. But the point is, we are a work in progress. And we can all choose to be better versions of ourselves at work and to relate better to people. I hope that made sense, Adam. Bill?
Mm-hmm. Karuna, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you, you know, insightful in ways that I probably wasn't even expecting. And it's been a lovely chat. I'm imagining that there's going to be some people that are keen to reach out or to follow you up or to follow you more. What are the best ways for people to connect with you?
KRK.sg is the website, but you can send me an email at karuna@krk, that's kilo Romeo kilo, krk.sg, and I'll get back to you. And more than happy to help anyone who wants to be a better version of themselves.
Karuna, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. My pleasure and privilege.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Turnaround Mindset Podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please head over to iTunes, Google, or Spotify, hit subscribe, and share the podcast with someone you think would benefit from it. Don't forget to leave a 5-star rating. To download this episode and access other relevant content, please visit our website, www.theturnaroundmindset.com. Join us next week for another Turnaround Mindset episode, and remember, the only way it gets better for you is when you get better.